The date is Friday, February 23rd, 2001. It's about 3:30 in the afternoon. This is tape number one of a reading of the story Where the Bodies Are Buried 2020 by Kim Newman. Copyright, hold it. Copyright 1996 by Kim Newman. It's from the anthology Dark Terrors 2, edited by Stephen Jones and David Sutton. Copyright 1996. Published by Vista Books. This collection is a sequel to the original Dark Terrors, the Golantz Book of Horror. And this story by Kim Newman is a sequel to his story in the earlier book entitled Where the Bodies Are Buried 3, Black and White and Red All Over. So I'll have more to say at the end of the, I guess, the second tape. This story's like 50 pages long. Anyway, it's being read by Goblin Hood, as usual. And I'm going to go on and get to it. Where the Bodies Are Buried 2020 by Kim Newman. Spring Meadow, Illinois, any town, USA, in the middle America of the mind, a night in fall, a full moon. Chantal, consciousness uneasily nestled within the Tina simile, looked through the viewpoint character's eyes. As Tina, she stood alone in a patch of fenced-in park. The verdigrised town founder, a crooked politician 2 centuries gone, posed on a pedestal. The statue was in sharp focus, richly dimensional, palpably solid. Mimesis was generations beyond virtual. Dreamwelt was indistinguishable from actual, affording complete sensory interface. Through the Tina construct, Chantal heard cicada chirrup on the back track, felt crisp cold to the bone, saw breath clouding in damp whispers, smelled grass after rain. The indistinct receptors VR did not connect with were active. Her back brain was absorbing info bits. It would take conscious effort to scroll. A million tiny subliminals supported the dream. Spring Meadow tasted real. Initiate title sequence. Disembodied words ghosted in front of the statue, filling the night with letters of jagged green newsprint. where the bodies are buried. The words came apart like mist. She wasn't sure how to make the dream run. She couldn't swivel her neck. Her neck. To shift viewpoint. Pause. Don't try to think what it's like, Sister Chantal. Just let it happen. Jerome's voice seemed to come from empty air, blotting out all other sound and scent. Merely by giving the advice, he made it impossible for her to take it. Aural bleed through wavered the dream weld, shattering the statue into pixels. Behind the bead curtain of dream night, Chantal saw specter shapes. Jerome Rhodes and Roger Durock were watching over her, monitoring her progress. What was she doing, really? Sitting on the couch or standing like Tina, a puppet jerked along by the program. She felt the weight of the hood set, the pull of her regular body, the gravity of real weld. The curtain hung still. The statue reformed. Still, pause. She felt the cold again and heard insects. The specters were hidden. Calming, she tried to accept the dream. She recognized that she found it hard to surrender to mimesis. People do this for fun. She reminded herself, for entertainment. A smart program probed for a way around her mental block. She tried not to feel violated. Chantal did not trust stories, but they still fascinated her. She was not sure which of her conflicting reactions was wrong. As Tina, her viewpoint was fixed. It was like, don't try to think what it's like. Wearing a thick suit of too tight clothes, wired rigid, by an armature sewn in the lining. She could feel everything but do nothing. Her itch to move her neck affected the dream scene, shifting the vision field. 180 degrees pan. The movement was part of the dream, not of her volition. She saw more of the square, carefully trimmed trees, a white painted bench, abandoned civic buildings, a black cat, very convincing, lively alive, slunk through bushes, cringing in moonlight. Something dark wafted across the penny bright face of the moon. Atmos, Atmos. Despite blurb claims, it was not like being the viewpoint. Chantal wore Tina's dream body, but was a dibbuk, a passenger in her its mind. She could resist the dream, but impetus was to carry on with the story. Something gave. Run! Under the wind, chords sounded, building suspenseful. Her heart, hers or Tina's, pounded faster. That cat was gone, melding with liquid shadows. The moon was clear. The viewpoint looked around, not the smooth pan of the last movement, but quick, bird-like darts. The pan was to get the dreamer accustomed to vision field shifts. This was how people saw real welt. Through a skull camera mounted on a neck gyro, blurring transitions between shaky half hemispheres of surround sound cinerama. Tina was waiting, expectant, and a little afraid for someone. There was to be a meeting at midnight by the old clock on the town hall. Something of a cliche. It was a breath away from 12. Tina was maybe 15 years younger than Chantal, in her late teens. She wondered who the girl was. The dream reacted. A Tina Singleton packet opened, downloading info dump, flash images of parents and friends, establishing relationships, a rolling scroll of backstory, facts and figures about Spring Meadow, blips of childhood, blats of school, blurts of domestic terror. Tina was a good student, popular at Spring Meadow High. Her home life was uncertain, locked between feuding parents, sometimes mom. Reversal of expectations got zonked and hurt her. Dad didn't want to notice. Technically, mimesis was impressive, but not real, any more than reading a book or watching a motion picture. It was just a story. The wind raised a flurry of leaves, which swirled around the statue, drifted against her legs. She snatched an oak leaf, held it up. Through the viewpoint's fingers, it seemed absolutely real. She crunched it up and threw it away. How much information had she just converted? The park was deserted. Chantal stubbornly sensed Jerome and Duroc tuning in from outside Dreamweld. And something else. Another presence. Tina's nerves frazzed in fearful anticipation. Chantal was puzzled. This sharing of mind space was not what she expected. Tentatively, she clicked on Tina, allowing more seep through. Tina had been receiving valentines, collaged of newsprint, like blackmail notes. At first, sweet, thinking of us, of you, always. Then, sinister, intimating secret knowledge. How's mommy's little girl? Why didn't this twitette go to her school confessor? There were so many safety nets. Of course, Chantal knew why. This is just a stupid story. Logical behavior would spoil it. Today's note. Meet me. Town square. Around midnight. Unlike the others, it was signed in an arachnoidal scrawl. Rob Hackwill. The name triggered an eerie melody that rose and fell with the swirl of leaves. Another information package appeared, sealed for the now. Chantal intuited more backstory. Rob Hackwill was the villain, the killer, the monster, a blackmailer tortured to death by his corrupt victims, back from the grave for revenge on hypocrite and innocent alike. An angel, an agent of the devil, princess of hell, tormented and tormenting, a franchise from the last century, still lurking in the collective pop unconscious, while preparing her thesis on the Hackwill effect. Chantal had seen Where the Bodies Are Buried, the original motion picture, over and over. Before that, Hackwill had haunted her childhood nightmares. When her confessor suggested the academic work was an attempt to deal with earlier terrors, he had not told her anything she had not intuited for herself. Why did the first wide-release mimesis production have to be a dream make of Where the Bodies Are Buried? Why not Little Women or La Dolce Vita? Tina looked around, nervoso. She was sure it was all skit. Stacy Snyder, her bestest Amy, projected she was so funny. This was machismo. There would be payback in school tomorrow. Or maybe it was Jimmy Traynor. One of the Hackwill notes was about him. Your secret's safe. I know you, heart, 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 heart. Jimmy T. She had no secret crush on Jenny. No, she was lying to herself. Tina dezzed desperate that Jimmy would glom her. Chantal was frustrated. The teen think was difficult to follow. She tried to take over viewpoint, cutting the slango, communicating danger. From the back of Tina's cramped mind construct, she shouted, "Look behind you, run away, go home, pull up the covers, call the cops." She caught herself trying to influence a fictional character. She had not expected to be fooled in quite this way. It was absurd. Jimmy and Stacy were guilty. Tina was pause. Stacy had snitched her crush to Jimmy. They were gagging together in the bushes. Her heart would fraction again. There was no secret admirer. That scut was only in bad movies. Ha! And daydreams. There was no Rob Hackwill. Hadn't Tina registered the name? Didn't this town remember? There had been a dozen sequels. It was impossible that anyone wouldn't know. After 13 murder-filled films, Rob Hackwill should be as famous in the story welt as in the real. Of course, the mimesis wasn't so much sequel as remake. According to the blurb, this was supposed to reinvent the mythos, to take Hackwill back to his festering origins and make him a monster for the new millennium. Something barreled at her. A clawed hand grasped her shoulder. Music leaped like a jaguar. Her throat opened in screams. Scream. She was pulled around and knocked down. Gotcha! Even knowing this would happen did not make it less of a shock. Pressed into soft, grassy earth, she sensed the weight of the dark shape pinning her. She smelled a foul breath. She heard muttering. I know. Robbie knows. Robbie has always known where the bodies are buried. Her coat ripped at shoulder seam, sliced by a razor-edged claw nail. There was something like pain and something like warmth. Few want to be hurt in a dream, though the option's there. As the nail pierced Tina's shoulder, why would anyone want to pay for this? Chantel wanted stop, but had no control. Tina could not struggle. The monster had her. Chantel was completely sucked in by the viewpoint. There was no Chantal Jewelerat. SJ. Only Tina Singleton, doomed girl. The nail grew in her shoulder wound, scraping past bone, through ligament. Everything distorted. Pain substitute flooded her mind. The viewpoint was on her back, looking up. The statue stood above like a towering gravestone, a face thrust close to her, eclipsing the statue and the moon. Sharp teeth clacked, several centimeters of enamel exposed. A single red eye gleamed. An ice fist took her heart. The hack is back, and squeezed. Stop. Eject. The Dreamwell vanished like ice on a griddle. But there were after sensations. Chantel still felt Tina's terror. She needed a moment to reorient. She was on the couch, as when she had initiated, "Run!" Physically, she had not moved. Jerome fussed at the dream deck. He had ordered, "Stop!" Didn't he think she could take it? And was extracting the dream sphere from its tray. Eyepieces receded into her hood set. It took moments for hearing to return. Her brain had to recalibrate for reality after only minutes of mimesis. "Sister, art thou all right in thyself?" asked Duroc. She nodded and lifted off the hood set. She shook her hair out as if she had Tina's shoulder-length blonde fall rather than her own black bob, and scanned the inside of the contraption. Transparent padding protected a neural network of wires and crystal chips. The mimesis process was, in the end, only light. Dreams reached the brain through the optic nerves, duping neural receptors into interpreting nano flashes as sight, sound, smell, taste, pain, pleasure. But it was hard to remember the tech when a monster was kissing you to death. She waved Duroc away and looked a question at Jerome. "I thought you were losing yourself," he answered. "I'd have preferred to make the decision from the inside." "You're right, sister. I'm sorry." Both Duroc and Jerome used the archaic form sister. At the Euro Commission press conference in Brussels, she had been required to wear full habit for the cameras. She was embarrassed by the penguin costume, which made her a sexless non-person. She preferred a plain dark single piece with a discreet Roman collar. The floor swayed slightly, the ship easing on its moorings, not her strings being snipped. Her spinal spirit level was settling. She had her welt view back. She returned the hood set to its cradle. The E-Union Parliament had argued in circles about where to cite the Euro Commission on the Model Duff Amendment. Brussels had superior facilities, but a policy of positive anti-bias, against second generation members meant they were in Prague. The influx of bureaucracy with Czechia's 2-year chairing of EU put office space at a premium. Ecom wound up with the Gustav Meyrink, a riverboat at permanent anchor near the Charles Bridge. Subotai, the Mongol indentured to Ecom as minion, joked that the ship constituted the Bohemian Navy. Her quarters, one deck down, were not much smaller than her cell in Castel Sant'Angelo. Jerome, unused to the Cenobite life, nagged Edmin into getting him a hotel suite. Durak seemed not to mind his cabin. He had little baggage. Thoughts, sister? Tina haunted her, and the stab of Hackwill's claw was a phantom twinge in her shoulder. Not yet, Durak. This will take time. The tech has outpaced the psych. There'll have to be long-term studies. That's what the industry says, put in Jerome. But they regard mass audience as a field test. Mass audiences as a field test. We've too much gen on mimesis. Not enough cognition. Jerome Rhodes was English, an information analyst. Chantal was Swiss, a media psychologist. Their skills were supposed to be complementary. They had not worked together before Ecom seconded their services. Then again, the industry has been cooperative. Pyramid are allowing us dreams well before the public. Bodies hasn't been theatrical in the States, much less cleared for home mimesis. He was in his late 20s, which gave her a year or so on him. He cultivated a slender boyishness. She was not yet pause, a stray Tina word, suited him. He might be a template for her in-progress, back-burnered book file on information children, a global generation whose personality, values, and culture were shaped by media mass rather than religion, family background, social class, or nationality. Something had made him stop. Roger. Sometimes he seemed to assume comradeship with her as a fellow religious, though modelists, especially ex-Catholics, were obliged to cope with Georgi as dangerously soft. Sometimes she was sure Dirac put on an ominous warning act, subtly mocking those who expected thou and thine of him. The Reverend has decreed we must put away evil things. Dirac was an ex-cop. After the Europa Defense Forces, he had been with Interpol, specializing in transnational serial murder. He had put away three of the Hackwill killers, Pietro Marchone, Nadja Diel, Hugh Best. Dirac's law enforcement background, not his standing in the truth, earned him his place on ECOM. Jerome's company had informal ties with Media Consortia, which meant he balanced Dirac. As of now, the vote was split, Dirac for, Jerome against. Like any Swiss, she was neutral. Though resident in Vatican City, she did not hold an EU passport. Whatever ECOM recommended, the amendment would not apply in her homeland. It's not like virtual reality, she said. Except in the generic way, television is like theater. The industry cognates mimesis is the real thing, said Jerome, holding the dream sphere. It was a pleasing bauble, a flawless silver pearl. VR was a sidetrack. All you could do was chuck things at customers' heads or let them wander around CG environments. Remember when interactive was the buzz? That was big mistake uno. Punters want stories, not choice. Once they got past redoing This Is Cinerama and Zotzing Aliens, every fool zoned out of VR. That's why it's taken two decks to develop mimesis. When all those Millennium VR parlors went belly up, research funding dried. If not for Derek Leach's deep pockets, we wouldn't have the tech. And if mimesis rockets faster than Zonk cocaine, it still won't show a profit before 2050. Then again, Leach can afford it. This is like being someone else, Jerome. No, not like being. Like being in someone else's head. The stick figure of Tina Singleton came to mind. Same effect reading Pamela 2.5 centuries back. Sister Chan, or auditing an Oedipus or Hamlet soliloquy. The diff is, it isn't just words now. You're not on the outside empathizing. You're on the inside sharing. It's the work of the devil, said Duroc. Or Derek Leach, which Mum says is the same thing, said Jerome. Then again, Leach's Cloud Nine satellite net carries Reverend Modell's teleministry. Though there were no mirrors in the scene she had dreamed through, the viewpoint carried a self-image icon. Beneath the Hollywood cheerleader face, Chantal intuited a template with which she was familiar. Tina looks like Martha Wink, don't you think? Martha Wink was the Hamburg victim. Jerome was startled. There are resemblances, then again, there are differences. Duroc said nothing. Chantal found the file on the desk. She flipped it on and called up post-mortem glossies. The phantom intrusion in her shoulder matched a wound in Martha's shoulder. The gouge was a 3D rose through the wrong side of a stereoscope, a hole ribbed with red folds. We mustn't be too dazzled by the tech or the aesthetic, she said. Mimesis is just breaking. There's so much to cognate about how it works, what its potential might be. What we have to decide is whether it turns dreamers into murderers. After 2 years studying where the bodies are buried, kill clusters, Chantal was still unsure of the Hackwill effect. In Vatican screen rooms, she refamiliarized herself with all 13 films. Meanwhile, tapping into archives, she immersed herself in seemingly every incident of homicide that occurred during the 15-year run of the series. The Hackwill effect began as a newsnet scare patterned on long-running tabloid rumors that certain blues or heavy metal audio tracks were conducive to suicide. But evidence accrued like coral. Some people who watched bodies films went out and committed atrocities. Rob Hackwill reached out from screens to warp minds, making monsters of random members of the audience. Undeniably, there were murders. Equally undeniably, following a Newsbite lead, it was claimed in court by prosecution and defense that murderers were under the influence of the bogeyman. She scrolled through a media morass of interviews with Hackwill killers. The most interesting was the most talkative. Elizabeth Yatman gave a book file of detail about how Hackwill had turned her into a mass murderess. But Chantal intuited in Yatman's references an evasiveness that suggested only sketchy, second-hand knowledge of the films. No Hackwill fanatic would confuse Tina Singleton with Stacy Snyder, but Beth Yatman did. Yatman, nearly 50, was thriving in England's Broadmoor facility, happily claiming Hackwill made me do it to back chat sites, making encouraging noises to the pressure group campaigning for her release. An accomplished cook, she sent cakes to supporters and also to relatives of Hackwill victims. Spokesfolk RHV hardly needed to campaign for her continued incarceration. Chantel was inclined to class the Hackwill effect, a modern instance of Loudon or Salem hysteria, an arbitrary shifting of guilt onto something beyond self. Instead of the devil, a string of tame horror films were singled out and blamed for atrocities conceived and executed by apparently normal people. The oldest, saddest excuse of all: I was only obeying orders. Cardinal Kevin Menzies, her superior, allowed her thesis to be a first public acknowledgement that the Vatican had ever considered the Hackwill effect. Cardinal Kevin Menzies, her supervisor, allowed her thesis to be a first public acknowledgement that the Vatican had ever considered the Hackwill effect. She seconded the findings of a Sub Rosa 2004 inquiry, which recommended Yatman's request for exorcism be ignored. Not refused, ignored. The plea was one of Yatman's increasingly bizarre attempts to remain site prime news. Besides, Rob Hackwill was not officially recognized as a demon, nor was ever likely to be. There was still something about the body's films, something unhealthy, if not unholy. Yatman, like two other Hackwill killers, one of whom was never caught, murdered in and around the English backwater where Alan Keyes, writer-director of the original Where the Bodies Are Buried, had grown up. Leslie Conyers, victim of the unsolved Hackwill killing, was once Keyes' girlfriend. Another murderer was called Robert Hackwill. His name had lodged in Keyes' memory from childhood, resurfacing arbitrarily in his fiction. Could it be something in the water? Or maybe the popularity of the Bodies films was not casual, was not causal to the Hackwill killings, but parallel with them. Both might be symptoms of something else. It was not Hackwill that unnerved her. Once she was past adolescence, he struck her as an obvious loser with a stale repertoire. More disturbing was the Devil Princess, Hackwill's infernal mistress. It said much about Keyes' psyche that he chose to depict ultimate evil as a provocative teenage fillette who wore black leather and chains, or a scarlet nun's habit. Maybe it was the medieval architecture around her as she worked, but at the root of the Hackwill effect was something that made her yearn to leave the postmodern papacy of genial Georgi and take refuge in a Vatican which believed in physical war with the armies of the devil. While working on the thesis, she dreamed often. Her conclusion, deleted from the final draft at Menzies' request was that the church not rely on psychology in dealing with the resurgent Hackwill effect, but fall back on ancient spiritual resources. Her now cautious thesis was modestly posted on the Vatican branch of the World Tree, just as Morag Duff, on the point of yielding the EU chair to Czech Chancellor Martina Dernkova, set down the amendment as a parting gift to her successor. For century cadets like me, information is air, Chantal. We breathe it from birth. Jerome had finally not called her sister. For her, a little triumph. Actually, Mum's a nouveau Luddite. Won't have a flat screen in the apartment. Never downloads news bits. You're probably reacting to her. She taught me not to surrender to white noise, to scan only for what matters. Then again, usually I intuit when Jen matters, but not why. That, I cognit, is your job description. They were at a pavement cafe in the ghetto. An electric brazier melted the thin snow back meters away from their table and created a bubble of warmth. A mache golem, creaking with every move, served tall glasses of hot tea. Jerome played with his Kafka salad, picking out chocolate roaches. The tottering expressionist walls and tiny alleyways were processed styro, spray-coated to mimic ancient stone. Kabbalist graffiti covered graffiti art covered every surface. The place was less than 10 years old, an exact recreation of an original raised early in the last century. All the capitals of E-Union were becoming theme parks, even the Vatican. Subnational congresses passed laws requiring citizens to wear traditional costume in public. Australasian tourists expected it. Nearby, robotas, in the original Czech sense, indentured workmen, not machines, were restoring the frontage of a vandalized synagogue gift shop by abrading deep-etched, luminous, anti-Semitic slogans. Throughout the ghetto, there were rumors of a pogrom coming. Few Jews lived here, but misethnicists had as much contempt for the Mongols and Kurds collected in the beehive cell apartments stacked above these streets. A giant head popped into being above a public holo plate. Waves of white hair around a withered angel face, eyes augmented by burning azure overlays. It's Roger's boss, Jerome commented, the Modell man. Joseph Modell was the most successful evangelist. He synthesized saleable qualities perfected by U.S. teleministries of the last century, but preached old-world Puritanism and a work ethic that verged on slavery. doctrinally an economic Calvinist, politically a Mussolini fascist. He liked to compare himself with Savonarola, Malcolm Muggeridge, and Rush Limbaugh. The Holo began speaking simultaneously in Hebrew and Czech about the uprising in Cadiz. Modell harshly criticized EU refusal to let his relief workers deploy in combat zones. In a rare moment of passion, Pope Gheorghe had described Modellist rapid response teams as spiritual looters. During the Basque insurrections, RR teams dispensed medical help and subsistence food only in exchange for signatures on lifetime contracts with the Modellist ministry. I can't scan Roger, Jerome admitted. Why is he with Modell? He seems too clued to be a zombie. I've heard that said about me. Gheorghe's made it snaz to be a nun, Chan. His renunciation of the doctrine of papal infallibility is a major break with deadhead tradition. Then again, liberalism might erode core strengths. Strictly speaking, I'm a priest, not a nun. That's another Gheorghe reform for you. I'm sorry. It's hard sometimes to rewrite the program. Worry not. Many in the church have the same problem. Modell was talking about the amendment now, another declaration of intent with case histories. She caught the name Martha Wink. Scans like Roger reported back. She agreed. Then again, I imagine the Modellists have access to as much gin as we do. It turned out Martha was one of a group of tech buff teens who had rigged up their own dream deck and got hold of bootleg dream spheres from the States. The night before her murder, the girl had dreamed where the bodies are buried. Modell made much of the similarities between Tina Singleton's encounter with Hackwill and the actual killing. He's distorting the story, Jerome said. Tina's the viewpoint throughout. Hackwill doesn't kill her in the first scene, just marks her. Modell announced that Martha's parents were co-chairing the revived Relatives of Hackwill Victims group and supporting the Modell-Duff Amendment. The financial recompense to which they would be entitled if the amendment became law was unimportant, the evangelist said, because the Winks were independently wealthy. They just wanted those responsible for their daughter's death to be held culpable. Any settlement received from Pyramid Releasing, Modell actually named the leech company, would be donated to the ministry's spiritual war chest. So, if his law gets passed, Modell is in line for a credit injection. Then again, he's already independently wealthy, too. In its 15-year existence, Modellism had become the second richest church in the world. If his petition to assume temporal leadership of Liechtenstein was allowed, Modell would be in a position to challenge Rome. Cardinal Menzies, only half joking, suggested the Vatican develop first strike capability against the day the Modellist standard went up in Vaduz. She found Euro cash in her purse and settled the addition. Swiss francs or Australasian dollars would be more welcome, but Eurocrats could not afford to betray the currency. Modell was harping on malign Asiatic influences. One of the robotas heaved a bucketful of styro dust and grubby frozen snow into the Modell head, disrupting the hololink. Patches of see-through speckled the head like measles. The robota was a Mongol, one of the Genghis Khan trail refugees produced by the Sino-Tibetan crisis. His gesture was cheered by many bystanders, but a black-suited missionary at the next table looked on grimly, noting faces. The holo head kicked into its pre-programmed appeal for all the faithful to dedicate their worldly goods to Modellism, noting both the biblical imprecation to store up treasures in heaven and Liechtenstein's liberal tax regime. At the same time, Modell scorned the poor, the sick, the stricken. If God made some people victims, then that was his business and should not be argued with. In his wisdom, God had set up toll gates on the road to heaven. "I love God so much, Jerome," she said, surprised at herself. "Through my life, that has been my strongest relationship. It's never gone away. I've never doubted, not for a second." Modell offered sacraments of wealth and immortality. A credit card hotline number flashed on his forehead. "So why do I find it so easy to hate religion?" In the dream, Tina survived, but the mark of Hackwill was on her shoulder. She alone in Spring Meadow knew the monster's face. Chantal was almost used to riding viewpoint now, comfortable in the dream body, lulled along, mind-chewing over her midnight encounter. Tina walked down the corridor towards the lockers. The set was dressed with posters for the junior prom. Kids passing by wore 2019 fashions, box suits and skunk stripes, and toted set books. But the dream scene was classically archetypal. Tina, tartan skirt, white blouse, ankle socks, would pass as a teen queen in any of the last 8 decks. A hand fell on her aching shoulder. Chantal's heart leaped as Tina jumped. She whirled, prepared to face Hackwill, and was relieved to see her best friend, Stacy Snyder. "What's word, hummingbird?" Stacy chirruped. "What's tale, nightingale?" Tina replied. Arm in arm, the girls walked to their lockers, turning boy heads as they passed. Chantal's own secondary school in Geneva had been shaped by U.S. media mass into a multilingual imitation of Spring Meadow High. Some of the extras wore the faces that furnished her memories. You scan devastatee, teen. Hard night with Jimmy T. One hopes. Chantal looked side on at Stacy. Like all the supporting characters, she was almost totally convincing. An actress would have leased herself as a template for CG identity, converting her likeness and the character tics of a specific performance into a stream of info bits. Now the dream, orchestrated by a computer assisted talent, was recycling information as a semi-autonomous illusion. Serious, girl tick, you scan like death on drugs. I had bad dreams. Condolences. Processed and perfected. Chantal was fluent in French, Italian, English, German, Latin, and Japanese, and had a working knowledge of a dozen other tongues. She found Hollywood teen speak hard to follow. Processed and perfected. Tina's locker, where Hackwill notes had been delivered, loomed large in vision field. A subliminal thrum of dread built up suspense as she approached. Stacy blithely opened her locker and pulled out her set book. She shook it, disrupting the fog pattern on the screen, and tapped in the code for the biology text. Ugh, she said. It's annelids. Tina looked at her locker. She tapped entry code on the keypad, and the lock clicked free. Smatter, teen. You got Jimmy's severed head stashed? Tina took out her set book. The message icon was blinking at her. She meant to stab, delete, but knew she would spend the day wondering. She accessed the message, and the cut-up letters appeared on the set book's screen. Two nights, Stacy's night. What's it processed, teen? Tina looked at Stacy. A superimposition skull flashed on her pretty, pretty face. In Tina's head, Hackwill's laugh sounded. Absolute secret, huh? Tina hugged Stacy hard. Care, Stace. Take chance none. For me, please. Nichivo, teen. It's only annelids. I can process and perfect. No, not that. Really care. A frozen moment. Tina pulled back and looked again at Stacy's open face, fixing it poignantly in memory from the original film, where the notes were on paper, not screen. If not this heavy foreshadowing, Chantal knew Stacy would be Hackwill's next victim. She told herself Stacy was a simulacrum, wearing the face of a woman now auditioning for better roles. But it was still a wrench. Tonight, this girl chick would die.
transitional fade.
Even mimesis could not make its scan as real. When Tina shut her eyes, she was in school in the morning, warmed by sunlight glimmering through window walls. When she opened them a subjective blink later, it was after dark and she was outside her house, wearing a heavy coat against the cold. Like theater and cinema, mimesis cut and pasted bits of narrative into scenes unfolding faster than life. The irony was that it was technically easier to provide convincing, unedited actuality, but there wasn't a market. In real welt, too much time is wasted getting from place to place, feeding and cleaning, doing naught. This was reality edited for length, doled out in suspenseful slices. Here, the dream make was departing from the first, where the bodies are buried. The old film cut from the locker room to Stacy later that day, receiving her own suggestive note, taking a lengthy, gratuitous shower before dolling up for a date. In a dark, scary house, she was stalked by Hackwill and turned limb by limb into a mannequin. A classic image from the film was her living eyes trapped in a smooth plastic face, tears trickling down unfeeling cheeks. Mimesis required the story to be perceived from a single viewpoint. No cutting away to other characters. No privileging the audience with information withheld from the heroine. Right now, it was a first-person medium. Jerome reported the industry was experimenting with allowing the dreamer to hop from viewpoint to viewpoint, even choosing whom to ride through the plot. That was a generation or two down the line. As Tina trotted nervously through the night, constantly scanning behind her, Chantal realized the dream was taking the easiest possible alternative. Tina was going to sneak into the dark, scary house, the old Hackwill place, naturally, and witness the monster's torment of her friend. When she wondered how Tina knew where Stacy was being lured, there was an annoying, misty patch in the mind construct. Chantal recognized a program flaw. Whenever the dreamer spotted a logic lapse, the viewpoint threw up a strategic memory blank. The old Hackwill place loomed. Tina stopped to look up at it, giving a vision field of the major locale. It was a trid-vid synthesis of every haunted house in every horror movie, from the rusted gate hanging by one hinge to the single light in a gable window, the stone eagle over the doorway, to the bricked-up room in its own turret. Beyond the house was the graveyard where Hackwill had been caught and tortured by the mob. Chantal was getting ahead of the story. Presumably that flashback would come later when Tina got suspicious enough to track down Judge Jonathan and get the story out of him. Chantal's impatience made Tina walk fast forward. The front door opened by itself, and she stepped inside the house. A scream abused her ears. Error. The scream caused some kind of playback fault. Chantal lost Tina and found herself back in real world. The heavy hood set was giving her a crick in the neck. This time she was alone, but she had the sense someone had been in the cabin with her and just stepped out. More authentically spooked at that than by the cliché horror house, she considered getting up and looking into the walkway outside. It ran the length of the May rink. Her visitor, if visitor there had been, should still be in sight. Could it be Jerome Subotai? The hood set was too heavy, a design fault. She didn't want to get up. She twisted around, looking for the remote, and found it clipped to her breast pocket. She tapped. Run. Tina stood, fear frozen, in the doorway. Before her was a tableau. On the stairs, Stacy writhed, dead legs dragging. On the landing, looking down, was Rob Hackwill. Tina watched the transformation continue. Stacy's elbows kinked the wrong way and became notched and pinned joints. She held fingers to her face and gasped as they became bone-like chunks of wood strung together on wires. Stacy looked to her friend for help. Tina was rigid. Chantal was irritated at the dream's assumption of girly uselessness. Tina made no move to help or comfort Stacy. Stacy's face stiffened and drained of color. It was the crying mannequin image, recreated in Trid Vid. Chantal realized the moment was somewhat thrown away. Mimesis distanced her from Stacy, trapping her in Tina. In the original, there was a powerful sense of loss, not least because the actress playing Stacy was better than the inept ex-model cast as Tina. As a viewer, Chantal knew with Stacy's death that her pleasure in the balance of the film would be limited by the lack of the character. Now Chantal was confused. She couldn't be frightened for Tina because she realized even if the dream make diverged radically from Alan Key's old script, she was fundamentally safe. If the viewpoint died, the dream would end. Suddenly, she realized she was invincible in the dream world. With a surge of courage, she looked up at Hackwill, knowing him for a cardboard fiend. He had no power over her in Dreamworld or this shoddy simile. The monster stepped into the light. He moved like a human snake, hissing through lipless smile, red eye winking, talons grooved scratches in the banister. Hackwill prodded the Stacy Quinn with a toe point. In a tangle of loose limbs and twisted clothes, the dummy rolled downstairs. Twisted around, the head looked up, eyes pulled. pools of anger, face cracked across. A beetle crawled out of the fissure, a gratuitously icky touch. Tina stood her ground. Chantal wondered if she had short-circuited the dream by spotting the logic lapse. Would her realization that the viewpoint could never be in mortal peril trigger a fast forward to plot resolution? You think Robbie has no surprises left, don't you? Said the monster. He stepped down to Tina and reached out. His claw fingers lightly touched her face. His nail points were cold and sharp. We're to be great friends and collaborators, dearest. This rag doll is only the beginning. There'll be many others. And the work we have to do is such fun. Hackwill wasn't like Stacy. Up close, he had a different texture. There was something super real about him, a fuzziness in the detail. He shifted through levels of reality, catching the light differently from moment to moment, like silk or falling rain. He was not like an actor in a close-fitting latex monster mask, any more than he was like a real disfigurement victim. Hackwill leaned close to her and whistled softly through his bare teeth. She saw his red eye up close and intuited something unique in its depth. She caught a whiff of grave mold under a strong cologne. We're partners, sister. The sibilance of sister were razor kisses. Panic seized her. Everything spun out of control. Come now, Hackwill chided. Did you think I wouldn't recognize you, Chantal? We're old friends. Stop. Break.
He calls her Tina, Jerome said. Well, he calls me Tina when I dream it. Then again, there are playback variants. It's to do with the interface between mimesis and your back brain. It's always been metaphorically true, now it's literally so. Consciousness is inescapably subjective. We all see things differently. A tree, a painting, a girl. Hackwill knew me, Chantal insisted. Jerome had dreamed through the scene carefully. He was genuinely concerned. He trusted her word. The monster had talked to her, not to Tina, to her. Like a good information processor, Jerome was not denying the input, but trying to interpret it. In its blackwood and red velvet box, the dream sphere was inert. Chantal's reflection distorted in its curved surface. She was not quite ready to go back and dream the dark, scary house scene again. Maybe it's a programming glitch. Bodies is pre-release. This is only a test impression. I didn't feel alone in there. You're intuiting the presence of the talent. It's impossible to erase entirely. Who is the talent? Ultimately, Alan Keyes. He's the dream shaper, augmented by tech assists. Maybe he's just a marquee name, and subsidiary talents do the actual shape work. Not everyone can be a talent. It's inborn. Chantal knew about Alan Keyes. Rob Hackwill was his life's work. Obviously, he was still with the program. We'll have to take testimony from him.
Jerome smiled. It's fixed. Pyramid are setting up a virtual powwow. Us here, Keys in La La Land, wonders of modern science. She got up and looked out of the porthole. A restaurant floated by, trailing balloons under the Charles Bridge. On each balloon was the face of the Dalai Lama, overcrossed. Armalite 99 rifles. It was a fundraiser for yet another church militant.
Where's Dirac? She asked.
He left a holonote. His Interpol sources slipped him pre-release news, and he's haired off to Barcelona. Dark hints, hush, hush. He says it's a relevant mission.
Relevant to us or Modell?
Mr. and Mrs. Wink, the Euro Commission extends deep condolences for your loss.
Thank you, sister, said Herman Wink.
Chantal wished Dirac were here. Herman and Monica Wink, flanked by Modellist's bodyguards, spoke mostly through a lawyer whose single piece was fashioned by tiny tags. The couple did not strike Chantal as especially upset, but people took losses in their own way. Most of the other parents were unable to give testimony, spasming with uncontrolled grief or mind-blanked by sedation. The Winks were the official spokesfolk of relatives of Hackwill victims. Their pro-amendment petition was still downloading.
We take comfort that Martha was of the last generation, Monica Wink said. Her transgression was justly rewarded, but her lapse will guide others.
Jerome covered the audio and talked to Chantal. I'm not understanding this. Transgression? Lapse? As Modellists, the Winks believed their daughter marked herself for death simply by sampling the dream. By being murdered, she had cleansed herself and would be redeemed. Modell always used the analogy of investment, referring to those judged favorably by the Lord as wise savers whose investment had matured. Those who sinned were spendthrifts, whose earthly poverty would extend into the afterlife. Extreme suffering of the flesh could, in certain cases, wipe out the heaviest of debts.
It is certain Martha dreamed where the bodies are buried?
Herman nodded. Chantal thought a flicker of genuine hurt crossed Monica's face.
This is so, Herman admitted. She was led into evil ways by unhealthy associations. The Reverend Modell has prescribed mimesis as a tool of the devil, but Martha would not see the wisdom. She was willful.
Martha's murderer was still unknown and at large. I, Paul, established he was the same person, known to be responsible for at least 16 other killings throughout the E-Union within the last 2 years. The news nets inevitably tagged him as a Hackwill killer. The murders began at about the time Pyramid announced bodies would be remade in mimesis. Three of the last five victims had, like Martha, contact with bootlegs.
We comfort ourselves that our daughter's death serves a high purpose, sister, Herman Wink said. This evil thing will be destroyed.
We thank you, said Jerome. The Winks' lawyer broke the link. The holo projections of the witnesses and their entourage vanished. Chantal and Jerome sat alone in the hearing room. She loosened her collar.
They were a piece of work, Jerome said.
She flipped on Martha Wink's file, scrolling through the forensics, calling up pre-death clips.
She had looked like her mother. This isn't about them, Jerome. This is about Martha and the others. She was on deck, reading her breviary. After 14 years, daily duty came easily. As a novice, she had scrubbed cell floors between masses and her secular studies. Though clerical celibacy was abolished, it was no wonder. Few priests married. Who had the time? Shan, excuse me. It was Jerome with something important. He knew the breviary was her one inescapable daily commitment. Some Czechs have come aboard. They want to throw Subutai over the side. She had been aware distantly of the commotion. Modellists? No, regular fascisti. How many? Three. They walked around the deck. The fascisti, teenagers with Rommel coats, swastika tats, scalps, and top hats, had Subutai up against the rail. The e-com cook and one of the secretaries, both Czechs who openly despised the Mongol, were watching, not making a move. She tried to conquer her anger. Obviously, the fascists not holding Subutai, prepared to let her comrades do the tossing overboard for her entertainment, was Leaderine. She had a heavy girl, She was a heavy-set girl chick with steroid biceps and blonde Viking plates. Without saying anything, Chantal walked into the situation and angled a high kick at the underside of the Leaderine's chin, sticking the point of her pump into softness. The fascist staggered, dizzy, gulping. Jerome was equally astonished. The girl chick growled. She had a jewel skull inset in an incisor, and Chantal ducked under an attempted wrestling grasp. She heaved up, thumping Valkyrie sternum with her shoulder. The Leaderine went over the side with a satisfying splash, crashing through a thin ice lily. As devil princesses go, not very impressive, Hein. Chantal chided herself for enjoying the moment. The other two let Subutai go. My vows oblige me to forgive you your sins, but not forget them. You may leave by the gangway and fish out your wet friend. Good day. The kids bolted. Subutai nodded.